27-year-old managed to devour the first 30 hot dogs in only 3 minutes. The impressive win marked his 14th victory at the annual contest. He held the previous record, which was only one sausage sandwich, less than his 2021 record. Astronauts at China's space station have successfully carried out the country's first spacewalk. Two astronauts exited the core module of Tiangong to examine the station's robotic arm. They also elevated a panoramic camera and tested new generation spacesuits. The mission lasted 7 hours. According to the China Manned Space Agency, another spacewalk will be conducted soon. In June, three Chinese astronauts blasted off to become the first crew of the Tiangong station. They will remain there for 3 months.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 13th of July, that the fight against restrictive voting laws was the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War, and called Donald J. Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election a big lie. In an impassioned speech in Philadelphia, Joe Biden tried to reinvigorate the stalled Democratic effort to pass federal voting rights legislation and called on Republicans in Congress and states and cities and counties to stand up for God's sake. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Katie Rogers, Zolan Kano-Young, Nick Corasaniti, and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled, Have You No Shame? Biden Frames Voting Rights as a Moral Reckoning. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 13th of July, that the fight against restrictive voting laws was the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War, and called Donald J. Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election a big lie. In an impassioned speech in Philadelphia, Joe Biden tried to reinvigorate the stalled Democratic effort to pass federal voting rights legislation and called on Republicans in Congress and states and cities and counties to stand up for God's sake. Help prevent this concerted effort to undermine our election and the sacred right to vote, the president said in remarks at the National Constitution Center. Have you no shame, he asked. But his words collided with reality, even as Republican-led bills meant to restrict voting access make their way through state houses across the country. Two bills aiming to expand voting rights nationwide are languishing in Congress. And President Biden has bucked increasing pressure from Democrats to support pushing the legislation through the Senate by eliminating the filibuster, no matter what the political cost. In fact, the president seemed to acknowledge that the legislation had little hope of passing as he shifted his focus onto the midterm elections. We're going to face another test in 2022, Joe Biden said. A new wave of unprecedented voter suppression and raw and sustained election subversion. We have to prepare right now. He said he would start an effort to educate voters about the changing laws register them to vote, and then get the vote out. The partisan fight over voting rights was playing out even as the president spoke, with a group of Texas Democrats fleeing their state to deny Republicans the quorum they need to pass new voting restrictions in Texas. In his speech, President Biden characterized the conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, hatched and spread by his predecessor, Donald Trump, as a darker and more sinister underbelly of American politics. He did not mention Donald Trump by name, but warned that bullies and merchants of fear had posed an existential threat to democracy. No other election has ever been held under such scrutiny, such high standards, Joe Biden said. The big lie is just that, a big lie. About a dozen Republican-controlled states passed laws this spring to restrict voting or significantly change election rules, in part because of Donald Trump's efforts to sow doubt over the 2020 presidential election results. Republicans who have called Democrats' warnings about democracy hyperbolic argue that laws are needed to tamp down on voter fraud, despite evidence that it is not a widespread problem. They have mounted an aggressive campaign to portray Joe Biden's voting rights efforts as self-serving federalization of elections to benefit Democrats. President's speech in Pennsylvania, delivered against the backdrop of the birthplace of American democracy, was intended to present the right to vote as a shared ideal, despite the realities of a deeply fractured political landscape. Democratic efforts to pass voting rights legislation in Washington have stalled in the evenly divided Senate. Last month, Republicans filibustered the broad elections overhaul known as For the People Act, and they're expected to do the same if Democrats try to bring up the other measure, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, named for a former Georgia congressman and civil rights icon, which would restore parts of the Voting Rights Act struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013. In a statement, Daniel Alvarez, the communications director for the Republican National Committee, said that President Biden's speech amounted to lies and theatrics. Republicans had unanimously rejected the For the People Act as a Democratic attempt to pass their federal takeover of our elections, she said. There were also concerns among more moderate members of Joe Biden's party that the legislation was too partisan. Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have publicly said they would not support rolling back the filibuster to enact it. But other Democrats see a worrying increase in efforts by Republican-led state legislatures to restrict voting, along with court rulings that could make it harder to fight encroachments on voting rights. A Supreme Court ruling this month weakened the one enforcement clause of the Voting Rights Act that remained after the court invalidated its major provision in 2013. President Biden said last year that strengthening the act would be one of his first priorities after taking office. But on Tuesday, 13th of July, he sought to shift responsibility to lawmakers in Congress. The court's decision, as harmful as it is, does not limit the Congress's ability to repair the damage done, President Biden said. As soon as Congress passes the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, I will sign it and want the whole world to see it. His rallying cry only underscored the impossibility of the task. Neither bill currently has a path to his desk. Activists who had wondered whether Joe Biden would stake out a public position on the filibuster got their answer on Tuesday. "I'm not filibustering now," the president told reporters who shouted questions after his speech. It was strange to hear Eli Zupnik, a spokesman for the anti-filibuster group Fix Our Senate, said after watching the speech. He did a great job of laying out the problem, but then stopped short of talking about the actual solution that would be needed to pass legislation to address the problem. As President Biden spoke in Philadelphia, a group of Texan Democrats had traveled to Washington, D.C., where they were trying to delay state lawmakers from taking up restrictive voting measures. Both measures would ban 24-hour voting and drive-through voting, prohibit election officials from proactively sending absentee ballot applications to voters who had not requested them, add new voter identification requirements for voting by mail, limit the types of assistance that can be provided to voters, and greatly expand the authority and autonomy of partisan poll watchers. In Austin, Texas, Republicans vented their anger at the fleeing group, and Governor Greg Abbott vowed to call special session after special session after special session until an election bill passed. The handful of Democratic lawmakers who did not go to Washington were rounded up and ordered onto the State House floor. Sean Thierry, a Democratic state representative from Houston, posted to Twitter a video of a State House sergeant at arms and a state trooper entering her office to order her to be locked in the House chamber. This is not an issue about Democrats or Republicans, Vice President Kamala Harris told the Texas lawmakers when she met with them on Tuesday. This is about Americans and how Americans are experiencing this issue. James Tallarico, a 32-year-old, the youngest member of the Texas legislature, said the group of Democrats had gone to Washington in part to pressure President Biden to do more. "We can't listen to more speeches," Mr. Tallarico said. "I'm incredibly proud, not only as a Democrat, but also as an American, of what President Biden has accomplished in his first few months in office. But protecting our democracy should have been at the very top of the list, because without it, none of these issues matter." The restrictions in Texas bill mirror key provisions of a restrictive law passed this year in Georgia, which went even further to assert Republican control over the state election board and empowered a party to suspend county election officials. In June, the U.S. Justice Department sued Georgia over the law, the Biden administration's first significant move to challenge voter restrictions at the state level. "The 21st century Jim Crow assault is real," President Biden said as he listed the details of the Texas bills. "It's unrelenting, and we're going to challenge it vigorously."
We get people.
U.S. hunger crisis.
The issue of hunger is usually considered a serious problem, widely associated with certain poor countries such as Sierra Leone in West Africa or Haiti in the Caribbean. But hunger and food insecurity is an everyday reality of millions of people living in a powerful and rich country like the United States.
Sometimes embarrassing, but it's what you have to go through.
Is there a night that you and your husband go without food just to make sure the kids have food?
Most of the time. We will make sure that they have had their portion and maybe another portion before we would eat. And me and Dad have kind of gotten to the point of now that we only eat maybe once a day. All right, y'all. Let's settle down.
Hello and welcome to our show, We the People.
where we investigate political and economic issues related to the United States. And in this episode, a topic many might find unlikely: hunger in one of the most developed countries in the world. But why? Isn't there sufficient foodstuff in America? What about programs aimed at providing food for the poor? Stay with us as we search for answers to these critical questions. Thank you.
Kind of hard when you don't live in the state of West Virginia to be able to understand what really goes on here. It's like feast or famine at this point, you know, survival of the fittest.
I pulled myself up by the bootstraps so many damn times that I've ripped them off. I have two jobs and a bachelor's degree, and I struggle to make ends meet.
When lack of money and other resources leads to disruption of food intake or eating patterns, the situation is referred to as food insecurity. Limited or uncertain access to adequate food obviously abounds in the United States. Although the U.S. is one of the most powerful and wealthiest countries in the world, it indeed has a hunger problem.
There was, back in the 1990s, a moment when it was clear that military families were beginning to apply for food stamps, what we now call SNAP. And there was a concern about the optics of this. So in their infinite wisdom, the military and Congress created a program that was designed to provide a supplemental subsistence allowance. And that was almost identical to the SNAP program, but only available to military.
The number of families unable to put food on the table has grown in recent years. This is while official estimates show that there is no real shortage of food in the U.S., as there exists more than enough food to feed every single person in the country. So what's going on? We reached out to Daniel Kovalik to investigate the issue. He's a professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome, Professor Kovalik. First of all, isn't it strange that there is still hunger in the U.S., which promotes itself as the leader of the developed countries in the world?
Well, yes, of course. And, I would turn people's attention to a 2018 report that was done by the UN. I believe it was the UN High Commission for Human Rights on Poverty in the U.S., which talked about this issue, that you had at that time 40 million people who were food insecure. That number has gone up, especially after the pandemic. And look at the pandemic numbers themselves. The U.S., the richest country in the world, so far still has the worst COVID numbers on Earth in terms of the most people who've been impacted and the most numbers of deaths.
Many thanks. Stay tuned to hear more of Professor Kovalik's analysis later on in the program.
Children are probably the most vulnerable victims of the growing hunger crisis in America, a top food producer itself, where a whole lot of food is wasted, as more than 42 million people experience food insecurity in the United States. Millions of children have to rely on school for their regular meals. Hunger in America has soared to historic levels in the past few years, especially for children.
My favorite vegetable is carrots.
Why?
Because carrots are healthy for your eyes, and they have lots of vitamins.
My favorite vegetable is an apple, because it's nice and sweet, and you could really, eat, a lot.
But as with most activities involving children,
which vegetable don't you like at all, and why?
The celery, because sometimes when I taste it, I just get a nasty taste to it.
Families with young children across the country are facing their hungriest times today. There are an estimated 17 million children battling hunger, 6 million more than before the pandemic, according to official data. So how significant are these numbers? To find out, we're now joined by Don Dubar, activist and commentator based in Westchester, New York. Thank you for joining the show, sir. What is your take on the status of hunger in America?
Hunger has been a problem in the United States, a serious problem in the United States, most of my life, and I'm 67 years old. I was born in 1954. I have seen in the process of researching this topic over time, For example, in 1968, CBS news coverage of hunger in America, there were millions of food starving people in the United States in 1968. Since then, we've lost most of the union jobs. We have lost the many of the benefits that people had to protect them against unemployment.
Many thanks for your insights, activist and commentator Don DeBar.
Food insecurity has exacerbated considerably since the coronavirus pandemic began. More than 35 million people in the United States were already experiencing hunger back in 2019. With the COVID pandemic, life became much harder for the poor, and that number started to grow. Today, hunger is part and parcel of life in every single community in the United States.
Feeding Tampa Bay has been spending close to $250,000 a month, if not more, buying food, because the need is much greater than we've ever experienced. And so as a result, we have to do more. Post-COVID, we're delivering 2 million meals every week across our 10 counties. And it's important for folks to know that still is not enough. That still does not meet the entire need.
Families suffering from hunger do not have access to food or enough food. Many wonder how they would get their next meal, regardless of whether it would be nutritionally valuable. Therefore, living an active and healthy life is a challenge for millions of people as they try to survive in a land where they keep being promised the so-called American dream. But how has the coronavirus pandemic specifically made life harder for food insecure families?
Many people were thrown out of work. Many people lost not only jobs and careers, but many lost businesses. So of course, that in and of itself, when people thrown out of work and into poverty, would increase the numbers of food insecure people. Moreover, there was a breakdown in the supply networks due to COVID, due to the lockdowns, which also increased food insecurity. And in addition, of course, it increased homelessness. You have a lot more homeless on the streets of American cities.
When the global pandemic hit the United States, it caused two crises: a healthcare and an economic crisis. With businesses closed, many Americans lost their jobs, facing economic pressure to provide for their families.
I get paid biweekly, and sometimes we ran out of food. This pandemic has impacted me emotionally. I don't know where my food was going to come from next. What has stopped me from applying for additional benefits like food stamps? I'm hoping this will ride out and finish or
come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I first found out about the food drive online. At first, it was a big thing for me not to go down there because of my pride. And there's a lot of people that won't go because they're like, oh, I don't need that. Let's save it for family that really does. And when I realized, hey, I'm a family that really does.
There are also the unexpected medical bills piled up on top of expenses soaring during the pandemic. That created a surge of families desperate for food. Not all those facing hunger are considered poor. Many are just people who have lost their jobs after the coronavirus pandemic began.
When you start out in February of 2020 with millions of people being food insecure, housing insecure, in foreclosure and or eviction proceedings, and you have then pandemic and the closing of many businesses and the loss of millions and millions of jobs, what you're doing in essence is exacerbating an already structural problem.
Like other hardships, hunger does not affect Americans equally. Although it exists in all communities, but food insecurity harms certain people more than others. Racial minorities, namely African Americans, Hispanics, and indigenous Americans, are hit much harder by the crisis, in part due to systemic racism embedded within the U.S. institutions.
About 19 million people in America live in a food desert. And Johns Hopkins research shows that food deserts disproportionately affect people of color. Food deserts can be detrimental to its residents' health.
I grew up living in a food desert myself in Baltimore.
there were absolutely no grocery stores, pharmacies, or retail stores within miles of the area I lived in. We either ate processed food or we bought junk food at the nearest corner store. And well, with the combination of poor diet and other factors, the people in my household had chronic illnesses, and one even passed away prematurely because of it.
Rural Americans also experience higher rates of food insecurity compared to those living in suburban and urban areas. African Americans are said to be twice more likely to experience food insecurity than white non-Hispanic households. Hunger is also a problem for the growing number of senior citizens struggling with food insecurity.
And in rural areas as well, you have increased food insecurity and poverty. Meanwhile, it should be noted that while the poor and working class lost billions and billions of dollars of wealth during the pandemic, the rich gained trillions of dollars of wealth. So there was a massive transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top as a consequence of the pandemic and the lockdowns, which were done in a way that benefited big companies, benefited the rich, and hurt the poor.
The number of those suffering from hunger and food insecurity may be rising, but life has also become more difficult for those who were already suffering from hunger even before the pandemic hit. Many are persuaded to rely on programs such as food stamps or SNAP, as well as charity initiatives seeking to feed families and children.
Programs like Share Our Strength and No Kid Hungry, our campaign, went into immediate action to make sure grants were issued to schools to provide food, to provide PPE for curbside distribution of meals, to provide transportation for children living in rural or urban communities where their families could not get to the schools to pick up meals. All of these things were happening so quickly, and this is still going on. We're going into a holiday season, and the lines that you're showing on television at food banks continue to grow. Families are continuing to struggle, and these numbers continue to skyrocket.
The efforts remain inadequate in the Biden administration, which has sought to boost food stamps after it was heavily attacked by former President Donald Trump. The Biden administration has vowed to fight hunger in America. But what are the plans, and how successful could they be?
I think it's an issue that is not being dealt with, except by charities, by churches, by private institutions. The government has done little to deal with this problem, and it just continues to increase in America. Again, I think the way that the lockdowns took place, the way that the so-called stimulus plans that were passed to deal with the pandemic and the lockdowns, the way those things were structured benefited the rich and hurt the poor. Again, there can be no dispute about this.
Americans are no stranger to the scenes of cars lining up at food banks today. The Biden administration has been pushing for an increase in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. SNAP is a federal program that helps millions of low-income Americans put food on the table. Across the United States, there are 9.5 million families with children on SNAP. The number of food insecure Americans is growing all the time.
It just seemed like, you know, we're never getting ahead. We need some more money. We need another income to kind of make things happen. So we decided Stephen was going to look for work too. And he found work as a bus driver, a school bus driver. And which is great. And we found a child care provider in the neighborhood who's been great. And so he started working. But once we had a few paychecks under our belts and we had to submit our report to the food stamps people, we found out we didn't qualify for food stamps anymore. We gained some income by him going to work, but then we lost $300 on the food stamps every month. And we lost money to child care because he was working. So we still come out a little bit ahead, but somehow it never seems that way.
That's the answer.
Potato.
Formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, SNAP is the largest federal food assistance program to provide low-income Americans with cash benefits to purchase food. It's also supposed to offer reductions in healthcare costs. After all, food insecurity has skyrocketed through the pandemic for many Americans, but it has been an issue long before the novel crisis.
The UN, in its 2018 report, reported that in places like West Virginia, and in Alabama, in certain places in Alabama, you have huge areas without running water or sewage. Of course, you have Flint, Michigan, that has this now 5+ years of lead in their water, and Flint is not alone in that regard. The U.S. is, and I believe the UN has said this, the only country in the world so far that has de-developed. It is no longer a developed country. It is a third world country. And yes, for the U.S. to claim that somehow it is superior to other countries in this regard is just a joke.
Hundreds of thousands of hardworking individuals in the United States are truly living paycheck to paycheck. Therefore, one disruption, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, could really send somebody over the edge, unable to make ends meet.
Your husband is fully employed. How are you doing financially?
We were living paycheck to paycheck. He was bringing home $500 a week, so I found a job in the restaurant to become a server. First time ever being a server.
Are you still there?
Nope. I left, like, being busy the entire shift, and at the end of the night, have $60. That was crazy to me. I knew I was worth more than that. I knew I could make more than that somewhere. So I finally went out to Carmel, which is like 45-minute drive away from where I live, one way, and I got the job out there. They're richer out there. They spend money. They don't care about spending money.
So the tips are better.
Tips are way better. You get at least 20%. So you're making anywhere from $10 to $20 per table.
With the country's nutritional safety net stretched way too thin due to the global pandemic, the Biden administration must increase aid. But rushing more food assistance to more people is not enough, as it will not solve the problem, although it might help families with their nutritional needs. The federal government also needs to provide a permanent safety program.
You have, over the years, but particularly during the pandemic, this massive shift of wealth from the poor and working class to the 1% of America that now owns about 50% of the nation's wealth. Of course, the very redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top means that you have an increase in poverty and extreme poverty in the United States. And who is this affected? It's affected people across the stratum of American society. It has affected poor people in the cities, particularly people of color, African Americans, Latinos.
Due to the dark history of inequality, racism, and slavery in the United States, hunger has always been a painful source of struggle for the people. U.S. economic recession, such as the one in 2008, have turned hunger into a crisis for the U.S. government, here to stay for an indefinite length of time. And not just hunger, but all issues related to lack of access to food, such as the so-called food deserts.
There's a lot of money in Memphis, and there's a lot of poverty. You know, we have parts of South Memphis where whole streets and blocks are just vacant. It's like a war that people left due to some catastrophe, but it was just white flight and sprawl. And so what used to be a small family-owned grocery store is now a vacant building, and on one end of it they have a liquor store that's typical of South and North Memphis. Nobody is going to be attracted in terms of grocery stores, retail, to an area that is sparsely populated and looks and feels dangerous.
Worrying about running out of food or just skipping a meal to make sure your children have enough to eat has become a reality for many American families. With the economy recovering after a recession, hunger persists and takes much longer to return to normal. The hunger caused by the 2008 recession took almost a decade to return to normal levels.
Awarding of sacrifices and rewards among the population follows the same, the same direction, essentially, that the operation of the economy has followed for 40 or 50 years. That is, most of the benefits go to the very few at the top. In this case, we're talking about the benefits that were given to Big Pharma, for example, who were encouraged and to funded, all of the things that were done to develop vaccines the absolving liability and all of that. On the other hand, people who were working hand to mouth already, saw that, like waitresses, food service people, saw their jobs evaporate when their places of employment were closed down.
For now, the problem of food insecurity persists. When people are thrown out of work, it means they just do not have the money to be able to afford to eat in the ways that they used to. It is no surprise that when the economy begins to suffer, hunger begins to rise.
Before Corona came, this line was never this long, so it's definitely bringing more people out here.
We try to address long-term food insecurity.
We're seeing new families, families that have never come to us before, families that have been struggling to survive and have been very successful at doing that. But with COVID, with the loss of jobs, we're seeing those families return to us and return to a situation where they need us on a much more regular basis.
The U.S. government has not shown a great performance in the past years in dealing with the crisis. COVID-19 has indeed worsened the situation in the low-income families generally. It is crucial to note that while some suffer more than others, having access to adequate nutrition has to be a top priority for the whole nation. Thank you for staying with us on We the People. Tune in again next week when we come back with another episode. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Have a good time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs, published by the UN, EU, and World Bank, demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, senior editor of the Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading UN, EU, and World Bank Back Siege on Gaza. Stay tuned for more. A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs, published by the UN, EU, and World Bank, demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. The authors of the rapid damage and needs assessment, as the UN, EU, and World Bank called their study, go to great lengths to minimize Israeli regime responsibility for the dire situation in Gaza, exacerbated by the latest episode of bombardment in May. They use the passive voice throughout in an approach bid to downplay the Zionist regime's direct role in the destruction, for which reconstruction will cost some $345 to $485 million and take 2 years to complete. That is assuming Israeli regime won't obstruct it at every turn. Israeli regime leaders have sought to condition reconstruction on the return of Israelis held in Gaza. Rebuilding took place at a snail's pace after the last war, so there is every reason to believe that it will delay and hinder rebuilding once again. The authors of the rapid assessment state that the May 2021 conflict caused damage to Gaza's roads as if this were some unfortunate act of God rather than the result of missiles deliberately fired by the Zionist regime military at civilian infrastructure. In one such attack, an Israeli regime strike made a giant crater in one of the main roads leading to Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical facility, blocking the movement of ambulances. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, said that the attack on the main roads leading to Al-Shifa amounts to making the hospital the object of the attack. The Zionist regime killed more than 40 Palestinians in that series of strikes on Gaza's city of Wehda Street. But these specifics are omitted from the rapid assessment, which describes Palestinian needs in detail, but treats the Israeli regime's responsibility in abstraction, if at all. The Zionist regime siege and its deleterious effects on every aspect of life in Gaza are impossible to ignore, even for the UN, EU, and the World Bank. But these international institutions legitimize the Zionist regime siege on Gaza by stating that it was imposed due to security concerns. Yet the study's authors don't attribute this as a claim made by the Zionist regime and instead shockingly present it as a given. This shamefully whitewashes a plainly cruel and immoral siege that the International Committee of the Red Cross has affirmed amounts to collective punishment imposed in clear violation of the Zionist regime's obligations under international humanitarian law, that is, a war crime. As Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, writes, the Zionist regime's closure regime cannot be justified under any circumstances. The Zionist regime's policies in Gaza may amount to the crimes against humanity of persecution and other inhumane acts. By accepting the premise that security concerns justify the siege, the UN, EU, and World Bank demonstrate an eagerness to sanctify Israel's subjugation of the Palestinians living under its settler colonial rule. The true purpose of the siege on Gaza is not to protect the Israeli regime's security. Instead, it is to secure regime change by bringing Gaza's economy to its knees to weaken Hamas' resistance movement. The Zionist regime long ago admitted that the siege on Gaza is economic warfare. After all, it is hard to see how counting the calories that the Zionist regime allows into Gaza could reasonably be considered a security measure. Gaza has been under some degree of Israeli regime closure for the past half century, decades before Hamas came onto the scene. The Zionist regime has long isolated Gaza, rendering the territory a segregated, debilitated, and subjugated colony, as Ron Smith observed in 2019. The Zionist regime manufactures humanitarian crises through a siege to create permanent isolation and deprivation, which is supported by the international community through its political inaction and its supplying of humanitarian aid in spite of Israeli regime's legal obligations, according to Smith. The Zionist regime does this because most of the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are refugees with claims to return to their lands in what is now called occupied Palestine, claims supported by the international law. As Smith writes, that is an untenable prospect for a settler colonial state premised on ethnic purity. But why would the UN, EU, and World Bank back the security concerns excuse for a policy that has plunged Gaza's population of 2 million into profound levels of poverty, aid dependency, food insecurity, and unemployment, as described by Al-Mizan? Because they share the same regime change goal as the Israeli regime, as is made clear in the Rapid Assessment Report. These international institutions that have crowned themselves in charge of rebuilding Gaza want to see the restoration of Palestinian authority rule in the territory, as well as the internal Palestinian reconciliation and the democratically elected Palestinian Authority. The UN, EU, and World Bank want Palestinians to capitulate to the Israeli regime and surrender to its rule. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime has tightened its siege following the May offensive. Rather than unequivocally calling on the Israeli regime to lift restrictions, the UN, EU, and World Bank seek international efforts to support reform and strengthen the mechanism to facilitate and accelerate the import of sensitive goods and materials needed to rebuild Gaza's economic infrastructure and business sector. It's a somewhat oblique reference to the scandalous UN-enforced Gaza reconstruction mechanism devised after the 2014 offensive, allowing the Israeli regime to exercise total control over what building materials are allowed into the territory. In other words, the UN, EU, and World Bank want to support reform and strengthen Israeli regime restrictions on the Palestinian economy, particularly in Gaza, rather than do away with them altogether. These institutions are, meanwhile, promoting a building back better approach, ensuring that recovery and reconstruction efforts factor in resilience and sustainability and reduce Gaza's vulnerabilities. But for that to actually happen, Palestinians need to be free of the Israeli regime's colonial domination and the agenda of the international institutions that support it.
By escalating raids against the resistance factions, the United States of America is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the demand for a complete American withdrawal, as well as providing a strong incentive for the factions to escalate in return. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to start the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. This shift in the Iraqi position came against the backdrop of the exchange of bombings between the Americans and the resistance factions, which began from mid-June and reached the 28th of June when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Popular Mobilization Forces on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. The raids of the American occupation come to save Washington's face, especially after the repeated attacks that confused the Biden administration, in addition to the security and military losses suffered by his troops. It is now clear that the purpose of the Americans' continued escalation is to drag the Iraqi factions into an all-out war inside Baghdad and then in areas south of Iraq to create internal chaos. It's worth noting that since Biden took office at the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing operations have targeted the Iraqi resistance factions inside Syria, where they operate in coordination with the Syrian Arab Army. This explains the importance of the region for Washington, especially as it represents the soft loin that Daesh exploits to restore its activity. Hence, ladies and gents, behold the American Air Force being used again as Daesh, ISIS Air Force, simply to keep Syria destabilized. The Iraqi resistance factions have retaliated by launching about 12 attacks on American occupation bases in Iraq since last February. This will for sure represent real pressure for the Iraqi government to resolve the issue of the U.S. occupation as soon as possible before the ball of confrontation rolls and burns what is left of American interests on Iraqi soil. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to enter the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces, instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. Now, this shift in the Iraqi position came in light of the exchange of fire between the American occupation and the resistance factions, which began in June when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Hashd al-Shaabi on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, the American embassy in Baghdad was then targeted hours after American interests in western Iraq and other areas in neighboring Syria were similarly bombed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, by escalating these raids against the resistance factions in Iraq, the U.S. is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the full demand of a full withdrawal from Iraqi soil. Now, if the withdrawal is the ultimate goal for real for the American occupation, why are the Biden administration and U.S. forces escalating their fire against the Iraqi resistance?
First of all, we have to take into account that the escalation came after the negotiations between the Iraqi government and the U.S. administration has led nowhere. So here we have a situation in which the Americans sometimes say they are withdrawing, sometimes they say they are preparing to have the training courses for the Iraqi armed forces and the Iraqi police, and etc. Other times you see them barricading in their embassy, which is huge size of the land in Baghdad. So you cannot be sure about this issue that the Americans want to withdraw. Now, when you deal with a country as such, this means you are telling the people of this country that you are an occupation force, and consequently they are going to deal with you as such. So the Americans all the time are trying to portray the issue as that the Iranians are the Iranian-backed militias are targeting our interests and our bases in Iraq. If you note how much they pump this propaganda war in this regard, you will understand that people are tending to forget that the Americans are an occupation force in Iraq, and consequently they are going to be dealt with likewise, meaning as an occupation force. So these are the main things that we need to take into account whenever we are tackling the issue. Now you see that the Americans are getting a lot of strikes from the Iraqi resistance. We need to underline the word resistance, because there's an occupation force, and consequently they cannot retaliate with the way that, for instance, Trump would have wanted. And even if Trump was there, and I mean the Trump administration, the American army would not, and the American Navy would not agree to an escalation, because they know about their weaknesses in Iraq. They know about their weaknesses that have come in the last decade in the region and in the whole world in general.
Muhammad, what's very interesting is that since the beginning of this year, we have seen more than 50 attacks. One were actually said that happened by the U.S. administration. Others they were silent about, that targeted U.S. interests in Iraq, especially the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the Iraqi military bases that house U.S. troops in them, and the Erbil airport as well. We all remember that. In attacks often always attributed to the Iraqi resistance forces. In the event these attacks just increase and continue targeting U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, how do you think that the Iraqi government will maneuver around this fact in the upcoming talks?
Well, you have to take into account the complications that Mr. Kazemi is facing. You know, the Kazemi is what sort of a figure that was chosen to be in the middle between all parties, and you cannot be such a person and such a politician when you have a very complicated situation as the one in the Middle East in general, and specifically in Iraq, between all these forces that are around you. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran neighboring you, and you have the American administration and American troops occupying Baghdad. You have the Saudis intervening from here or there. You have other Gulf countries also. So it's a very complicated situation, and you notice that the Iraqi government is trying to please everyone. Whenever an American strike takes place, they criticize, for instance, slightly, but when the resistance retaliates, they try to make the those who carried out the operation as people who are not known, etc. So they are in a very, very in a real dilemma in this regard, in order how to deal with issues, because the issues are going in a very fast pace, and they cannot deal with the situation because of all complications.
It should be noted there, Mr. Muhammad, that since the Biden administration took the presidency in the U.S. At the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing campaigns have targeted the factions, Iraqi factions, Iraqi resistance inside Syria, where they coordinate with the Syrian Arab Army their operations there, because it is the perfect spot, the soft point that Daesh, ISIS, usually exploits to try and restore its activity. How on earth does the world not condemn the U.S. basically being Daesh Air Force there? They are playing the role of protecting the area for ISIS to return to that area. How does the world just keep silent?
Well, the world is keeping silent because of the American hegemony over the media all over the world. And so the things are quite clear in this regard. I mean, even when you go back to the times when I know this has been reiterated, discredited a lot. The Trump declaration that it was Clinton who created Daesh, and on the issue of the scandal of the emails, etc. But still, the whole world knows, and even Iraqis sometimes had video.